The year is 2001. I've been reading about the infamous Battle of the Somme since I was about 8 years old, and by now I was in my mid-30s, and I was finally here on the trail of my grandfather and my great-uncle Henry, who will always be here forever, buried in the Commonwealth War Graves Commission Cemetery. I'm with a business colleague. For several years, my life had revolved around my small business and the challenges of managing staff, clients, management accounts, VAT. But now I was distracted from my business. I was distracted by those battlefields of the Somme. I was finally here. Tomorrow we would head out onto those sacred fields in search of my ancestors' footsteps. But first, we needed somewhere to stay. In those days, there were very few billets on the battlefields. There were very few visitors compared to today. The one we use now on most tours, number 56, Bed and Breakfast at La Boisselle, and the modern Ibis on the edge of Albert did not exist. So we found the Royal Picardy Hotel on the Amiens Road, on the outskirts of Albert, the old base town for thousands of Commonwealth soldiers, a few miles behind the front line between 1914 and 1916, and part of the front line was actually the town of Albert twice in 1918 and briefly, as we'll see, in 1914 as well. The town of Albert would be our base. The Royal Picardy would be our billet. So for years and years since that day, 25 years ago nearly now, I've long had a fascination with this small town. The following year, I returned again and I stayed in a hotel opposite the famous basilica that is the main landmark of the town. Rumour was that this place had been used by the Gestapo in World War II to interrogate people, and that was a chilling thought as I rested my head on the pillows, because the walls of those hotel rooms appeared to be so thin. You could hear the echoes of what had gone on before. The next day, I hired a bicycle from the tourist information office, which was next door to the hotel, and ventured out onto the battlefields, armed with my camera and a notebook. And during that week, I got to know those sacred fields so well. So this week, in my first podcast of 2026, I wanted to talk about that town of Albert. Why was it so important to the Allies? What was it like to be billeted there whilst the German shells dropped all around you? And what about the locals and their houses and homes? And what happened to the town after the fighting stopped? I'm going to have a go at answering these questions and much more with the help of the famous author Martin Middlebrook, newspaper archives, and a book I've used before in the podcast, Goodbye to the Battlefields, by the World War I veteran H.A. Taylor. Albert is an important but possibly overlooked part of the Somme story. To understand the story of the Battle of the Somme, you've got to appreciate the part that this small town played for 4 long years. And why, as we shall see, so many veterans returned to it in the years that followed. Now, I mentioned Martin Middlebrook, the famous author who died about a year ago, and with his beloved wife Mary, he wrote a book called The Guide to the Somme Battlefields. And this book covers not just the two world wars, but previous conflicts that those same battlefields had seen. And in that book, Martin tells us that when he wrote it in the early 1990s, so 10 years before I arrived there, Albert had about 12,000 inhabitants and was the third largest town in the Somme department. And it has a rich history. Henry V passed through the town in 1415 on his way to Agincourt. It had been a pilgrimage centre since the Middle Ages, when a shepherd had found a miraculous statue of the Virgin Mary in a field outside the town, close to where the Bapaume Post Cemetery now stands. Now, the large basilica that still stands, or is rebuilt and stands above the town, was built as recently as 1897. So when it was destroyed in the First World War, it was less than 20 years old. And there was a golden virgin and child on top of the tall tower. And now, I don't know about you, but when I go to the battlefields and you go up to Poitiers or Auvillers or anywhere around there, you look back on a nice sunny day, you can see the sun shining on that golden virgin. It gives you a marker of where you are, along with the view of Thiepval, which as you look back from Albert is across to your right. Now, when war came to Albert in 1914, there was only 8,000 inhabitants, and 2,000 of those were employed in the metal industry. There was a large sewing machine factory in the town, and it's mentioned several times in the accounts of the wartime soldiers as a place of shelter. Now, most of the time, Albert was a couple of miles behind the front lines. But in 1914, it became a frontline town, really, because the Germans got so close to taking it. At this stage, the British were not there. It was the French they were fighting. The British didn't arrive until the middle of 1915. And on the 15th of January 1915, during that fighting, a shell struck the top of the Basilica Tower, and it caused the statue to start leaning over. There are so many, if you Google it, there are so many famous photographs taken during the war of the Golden Madonna hanging precariously. Now, French engineers, they managed to secure it on the following day, and it remained in a horizontal position for the next 3 years. And rumour had it amongst the Allied soldiers that the war would not end until the statue fell. The town passed into British occupation, as I said, in 1915, and it sheltered many troops that were moving up to and from the trenches. The tower of the Basilica was used by artillery observers, and the body of the church was a major dressing station during the opening days of the 1916 battle in July of 1916. Then, of course, the battle moved on, and as we'll see, the town of Albert, the locals, did actually try to return and start to rebuild it. But it had to be abandoned on the 26th of March 1918, during the German spring offensive. The 7th Suffolks of the 12th Eastern Division, they were the last to leave and take up positions on the high ground astride the Amiens Road, close to where that hotel was that we first stayed at in. German Marines entered the town and were ordered to advance further, but they couldn't do so because of heavy British machine gun fire. And also, the Germans suffered a major disappointment and a crushing blow to their morale because they'd been told by their military leaders that the British were out of supplies. They're on their last legs, effectively. But when the Germans arrived, they found enormous stores of food and drink in Albert, and the German soldiers that arrived there had been without rations for 2 days. On the 16th of April 1918, British guns finally destroyed the tower of the church to deny its use to German observers, and then the statue fell. The statue that fell was never found, and it was thought that it was sent to Germany to be used in the war effort. The town of Albert was recaptured after hard fighting by the Eastern Division, the 18th Eastern Division, in August of 1918. And there's a plaque on the Hotel de Ville, and it says at the end of the war, there remained only the name, the glory and the ruins of the town. After the war, reconstruction of Albert was helped because it was adopted by four places. Bordeaux, an undamaged French city which became godmother to this destroyed town. Famously Birmingham, because the Royal Warwickshire's presence at various times during the war, and there's actually a road that was renamed the Rue de Birmingham. It's also linked with a town in China which had a French community, and also a town in Algeria which had French settlers from Picardy. The city of Birmingham paid for a large old people's home, and it still serves that purpose. The Basilica was rebuilt exactly as it was before the war. The town became a centre for the War Graves Commission work and was often visited by battlefield pilgrims, as we're going to see later in the podcast. Now, in 1940, war again came to Albert. There were virtually no Allied troops in this part of France when two German
panzer divisions swept from the east in May of 1940. The 7th Battalion of the Royal West Kents was a territorial battalion, wasn't fully trained, had no proper anti-tank weapons, and it found itself in Albert on the 20th of May, and it was hit that morning by the 2nd Panzer Division, which came up the Perrone Road. There was a short battle on the edge of the town and in the square in front of the Hotel de Ville. There was 20 British dead, and the remaining members of that battalion surrendered. Amongst the items captured by the Germans was a fully equipped British ambulance train, which was stranded at Albert because the lines on either side of the town had been bombed. Before being evacuated, British nurses had treated one patient, a young woman refugee in labour whose baby girl the nurses delivered in a room at the station. The mother told the nurses that she would call the baby Brigitte. Four of the locals from Albert died in the German concentration camps. One of them was a man called Derek Pickett. His father is believed to have been a British soldier who returned to Albert after the First World War. A fifth local man was killed at Amiens prison when it was bombed by the RAF in February of 1944. Liberated in September 1944, but it was the scene of a setback during that British advance. A battle group made up of Sherman tanks, the 2nd Grenadier Guards, approached the town from Milt, but met with unexpected resistance outside the police station. One armoured car was hit and two men killed. One of the Grenadier infantrymen was also killed, as was an over-enthusiastic Frenchman who'd run out onto the street to celebrate. The Germans slipped away during the following night, and the 50th Northumbrian Division completed the liberation of Albert the next day. So what can you find when you go to Albert? Well, it's a lovely place to visit. During the day or in the evening, there's lots of cafes there and restaurants and bars. One of the most popular bars was called Corners, but sadly that closed down about 18 months ago now. But if you do visit there, there's plenty of other places where you can relax after a day out onto the battlefields. We talked before up in Belgium about demarcation stones. These are stones that were placed locations which marked the limit of the German advance in 1918. And there's one on the edge of Albert on the Amiens Road. And if you go to the Hotel de Ville, on the wall of it you'll see a memorial to the Machine Gun Corps, which was erected in 1939 by the Machine Gun Corps Old Comrades Association. And it reads, to commemorate the glorious heroes of the Machine Gun Corps who fell in the Great War. 170,500 men of all ranks served in the Corps, of whom 13,791 were killed and 48,258 were wounded or missing. Upon the battlefields of which this place was a pivot were fought some of the most famous actions in which the Machine Gun Corps distinguished itself. As I mentioned, it was unveiled at Easter 1939, and then just about over a year later, the Germans arrived once again. Now, there's a cemetery in Albert called the Albert Communal Cemetery Extension. It's in two parts. There's a small raised section near the road, but behind that is a much larger one. This cemetery was designed by possibly the most famous architect of them all, Sir Edwin Lutyens, famous for the nearby Tietveld Memorial. The cemetery extension was used by fighting units and field ambulances from August of 1915 until November of 1916, particularly in and after September of 1916, right in the middle of the Battle of the Somme, when field ambulances were concentrated here in Albert. And then as the battle moved on from November 1916, the 5th Casualty Clearing Station used it for 2 months, and then it was used again at the end of August 1918 when Plot 2 was made by the 18th Division that were here then. And then during the Second World War, the extension was used again, and British casualties were buried there from isolated graves in and around Albert. There's now 862 First World War casualties buried there and 25 from the Second World War. And very few of them are unidentified, only 12 from the First World War and 8 from the Second World War. We don't know who they are. But But this is a cemetery that's well worth going to because there's so many interesting burials there. The first one that was buried there was a man called Private H. Mason. He was serving with one of the tunnelling companies, who was overcome by gas and fell down a mine shaft on the 31st of August in 1915. And then there's one of those dreadful communal graves. 13 men from the 10th Battalion of the Essex Regiment that were killed in November of 1915 when the Germans exploded a mine at the Glory Hole at La Boisselle. Now, we're going to have to do a whole podcast on the Glory Hole. It's very close to the famous Loch Nagar crater. It's on private land, so you can't walk on it, but if you go along the road that leads from the main Albert to Bapaume Road, you can see the mine craters that are still there. If I remember correctly, there are still some of those men that died in the mine explosion are still beneath the ground at La Boisselle. There's also the graves of Major T.C. Richardson and 2nd Lieutenant A.J. Latham. They were serving with the 185th Tunnelling Company, and they were killed with 18 of their men when poison gas filled mine tunnels near La Boisselle. And that was the result of another German mine that was blown in February 1916. So I think, if I remember right, what happens there is that when there's an explosion in the mines where these men have been working, it sucks out all the air and replaces it with carbon monoxide, which of course is poisonous and odourless, and that's how those men died. There's some senior officers there as well. There's Brigadier General H.F.H. Clifford, DSO, Distinguished Service Order, shot by a sniper in September 1916 whilst he was inspecting trenches near Mametz Wood. And there's also another communal grave, 11 men from the 41st Durham Siege Battery and an Army Service Corps driver, all killed one night in July 1916 when their ammunition unloading party in Albert was hit by a heavy German shell. And then there's a few special memorials to soldiers known to be buried in the cemetery, but the actual location has been lost. And in the upper level of the cemetery, there are six men who died in the First World War who were serving with the 7th Battalion of the Royal West Kents. And that may sound familiar to you, because when we were telling the story of the German arrival in May 1940, it was that same battalion of the Royal West Kents. Maybe the fathers of the men that had been there in the First World War that tried to stop the German tanks. And then nearby is a French cemetery known as the Albert National Cemetery. It contains the bodies of 6,292 French soldiers, and nearly half of them are unidentified in four mass graves. And this is the fourth largest French cemetery on the Somme. About 30% of these men died during the fighting on the Somme in 1914, 1915, before the British arrived, and then 60% of them from 1916. So the French, as we know, were fighting the south side of the Somme River, and 10% of them from 1918. So what was it like to be at Albert in 1916? Well, as usual, rather than looking in the history books, I like to hear what the soldiers themselves had got to say. And this account was written by a man called Guy Chapman, and he was serving with the 13th Battalion of the Royal Fusiliers in July, just after the start of the battle. The date of this account is between the 6th and the 9th of July. And he says that his unit were being moved down to the Somme battlefields from the north. And as they went through the town of Doulons, they saw a finger post and told them that they were 8 kilometres away from Albert. And then he says, we limbered stiffly to a hamlet half a mile off the road. Bressel, its name, a tiny place with a few houses and fewer inhabitants. Chapman then talks about him and another officer called Leader investigating the local Harrods, as he calls it. Now, for people that don't know, Harrods is a famous and very posh upmarket department store in London, and was then. So he's being sarcastic here, isn't he? He says they found 2 tins of sardines, 1 of condensed café au lait, 2 bottles of Beaujolais, 4 bars of chocolates and 2 packets of biscuits rewarded our enterprise. Towards evening, we were ordered to detonate a couple of thousand Mills bombs. These were those small pineapple-shaped hand grenades. This treacherous work was usually carried out by small parties in some embattled recess. But now there was need of haste. 300 men squatted in rings of six or seven. We moved from group to group, looking over shoulders to see that the safety pins were properly split and bent back. But then the worst possible thing happened. These are my words, not his. He says, suddenly there was an explosion and a shout. Pieces of iron hammered and slapped against the walls. Three of the battalion were lying in a bloody group. One holding his stomach was screaming. Stretcher bearers ran up and carried the wounded away. The detonating went on without pause. So one of those grenades has gone off, hasn't it? The transport came in next day and we received a brigade order to move to Albert. Fairburn and I rode to Albert that afternoon, clattering in under the Leaning Virgin, and found a house in the street that leads out to Bapaume. There were beds on the first floor. And then, whoop, crash. A shell banged into the yard of the factory across the road. Planks and pieces of timber whirled in the air, clapping down on the stones. The clerks were arranging the front rooms for my office. My Batman put his head in and said, "There's Turnbull from number three who wants to see you, sir, and Mr. Leader's dead." If you remember, that was the officer that he was working with the previous day. My mind shot out to that cheerful, comradely leader. We'd scarcely considered him last night. We felt sure we would bear him through all the tribulations. A red-headed Turnbull, his creamy skin pale beneath his freckles, his eyes shadowed with grief and fear, slipped into the room. His uniform was plastered with clay and he had no rifle. So let's now hear from the soldiers themselves. Horace Ham was a man that was serving with the Middlesex Regiment in the First World War. And he told the Imperial War Museum what it was like to arrive at Albert in the build-up to the Battle of the Somme.
They started putting us on square bashing again. So we all grumbled, complained, and they took us off for that. Those who had been wounded didn't go on for anything like that. Until one morning they come, one evening they come and say, "It's fall in, about 20 of us. Get your kit together, down to the docks, over the water to France again." And there I went to the 12th Middlesex, up at Elbert. That's on the Somme, all the Somme. I was on the Somme actually 2 years.
How do you feel going out again?
Oh, not much. Not very good. We didn't, well, you could, oh, you had to go. I mean, anybody who tells me they were, I've heard people say, "Oh, I'm not windy." I reckon everybody had fear of being killed, but you didn't know when the shell was going to pitch on you. And yeah, put that aside, that's only a detail. But we went out again, and I joined the 12th Battalion of Middlesex at Elbert. Oh, Elbert was a town, the people that were living there, and they were there at Elbert. I don't know if you ever heard of the tale of the Leaning Virgin. Well, I've been under, I stood under there many times. It was on a church. A German shell knocked, there was a Virgin very upright, and knocked her sideways. And the French engineers went up and wired her up so she couldn't fall. And the story was that when that fell, the war would end, but it didn't. Anyhow, we was in Albert in the neck for all month or so, going up to the line.
Now, this next account is told to us by a man called Arthur Upfold, who was serving as a private soldier. And he not only tells us what it was like to be in Albert, but he then explains his experiences of going up onto the Somme battlefield itself and seeing a dead German soldier. And it makes him realise the reality of what could face him.
We started off to go up to the line.
We went through various places, but not many towns where there was any life at all. Most of it was in the open country. We did pass through a town called Albert, and that's where we went back again. They had, that was completely shattered. I don't think there was a building that wasn't in ruins. But we went through that. And we got nearer, as we got nearer to the line, I hadn't, well, most of my friends hadn't been in the line before. And there was a sergeant taking us up. And the first introduction we got to a German soldier was one who was lying dead there, face down on the ground. The sergeant knew that what we'd got coming to us and what we'd got to get used to. So he just said, "Does anybody want to see a dead Jerry?" That's what we used to call them. And we all crowded round. I don't think up to that time I'd seen a dead body. But he put his foot under this German and turned him over. And that's when we got the first shock. What was left of his face? All the skin and everything was gone. And what was left was crawling alive with little maggots, eating the flesh away from his face, his eyes and everything. What was left was completely black, although he wasn't a coloured man. And there were flies, blue bottle flies, flying all around him. It was a terrible sight, really, to see a face like that. I don't know how long he'd been lying there. He must have been there for several weeks, I should think. But that was my first introduction to a dead Joey.
Horace Gaffron served with the Gordon Highlanders on the Western Front, and he was also in Albert in the summer of 1916. This is what he said.
The cathedral spire was falling to bits, and the big stone was the statue was hanging over, and they had cabled it up to support it. I believe they got it down, and they put it up again. Next peace time. You were dodging all the time. You were very much aware of the fact that you were under fire. At Albert, you were totally under fire. And our casualties were very, very large. Freikorps was the front line, and Mametz was the front line. And we came up and stopped there. You had an idea where you were. And you could tell by the landscape, if you watched the landscape. I can see the road yet, but it can lay me down. And I went back some years later. I went back in 1928. And I remember the trees, the bushes, was the trees, and they'd grown up. But I could still see the village, and I could still see the valley and make it out. And the cathedral was still there. The casualty clearing station I was taken to in Albert, when they brought me off the stretcher, my foot hadn't been amputated yet, you see. A fellow came, a sergeant in the RAMC, came to take my particulars, and I was just fully awake. And he happened to be my school friend, So he said, good God, he says, Horace, he says, you're in a bloody mess. I was in a mess, see.
And I think the casualty clearing station that he was talking about there was in the Basilica itself in Albert. So this next account is the first one of the accounts from after the war. And one of the first people to revisit the Somme in 1919 was the journalist Philip Gibbs, who'd been there during the war itself. So he was familiar with a lot of the places he visited in 1919. It was less than a year when he went there. It was, in fact, in September of 1919. He says all British soldiers and Americans who were with them during the last phase will remember Albert because of that church from which the Golden Madonna hung head downwards with her babe outstretched, until after March last year the statue fell under an avalanche of red bricks and rosy dust. Scores of times during the war I saw Albert under fire and passed through it on the way to the Somme battlefields. And I saw it when our guns finished the ruin which the Germans had not quite completed, until all was smashed to fragments and not one house was standing. Now, amidst that wild chaos of destruction, some people of Albert, a few hundred, have come back and built up little wooden houses called the Villa of Hope, and other optimistic names, where they provide light refreshments for tourists from Paris. Yellow men, he calls them, from China, German prisoners and British labour companies living still in the desert beyond, where they are clearing the fields of dead men and live shells. Like Amiens, the town of Albert has begun its new life, at least so far as having a few inhabitants again. But to these peasant folk, the outward symbol of Renaissance is a new church of their own faith, which has been built for them temporarily near the old church by the American Red Cross. It is a wooden hut, large enough to hold 200 people or more. The Archbishop of Amiens came to Albert and, after high mass in the wooden church, spoke to the people who had gathered there as pilgrims to their old town. Through the open windows, as he spoke, one could see the wreckage of their homes, and the words he spoke were inspired by that scene. Wearing his robes, a tall, richly coloured figure, as though he'd stepped out of a medieval painting, he was stirred with the same emotion that moved those peasant women in their black weeds, and those sturdy men of Picardy when he told of the new hope that lay in the future, now that the damned days, as he called them, had passed with their horrors, their slaughter of men, and their degradation of humanity. Sin had brought the war into the world, he said, and had caused all that ruin. Now, by the virtue of people, by a new faith born out of agony, they could look forward to a new world and rebuild the country that had been destroyed. Gibbs went on to say that he met the Archbishop as he walked afterwards in the town, blessing the people who had come back, and he said, "We're making a beginning, no more than that, to give life again to the poor, stricken place. It is a day of great heart, of good hope, but it will take a long, long time to make this desert fertile." He glanced towards the Somme battlefields up the road to Bapaume. "Up there where I walked, it was lonely, as of old, and the desert remained with its trenches sitting in, its shell holes in which weeds were growing, and the great mine crater at La Boisselle, the dead trees, the litter and filth of old battles, the entanglements of barbed wire, the dumps of dud shells, and the salvage of war material hardly changed from the old fighting days. Only a few tourists in great cars from Paris, which stayed in Albert, wandered out as far as this. The yellow men," that's the Chinese labourers he's talking about, "squatted around the estaminets. A group of German prisoners without escort sauntered by cheerfully." They were slowly going home now. "And up by Poisiers, some Australian soldiers were playing basketball near the great graveyard of their comrades. Beyond, by Delville Wood and Highwood, Longueville and Mametz Wood, there was an immense solitude." Now we're going to leave the story of Albert for a moment, because just reading that account, it reminded me of another story that I read from a newspaper that was printed in 1935. This particular newspaper had asked for stories from veterans. This is, 17 years after the armistice. unusual stories that would bring the battlefields to life. And this one really intrigued me. The article is entitled The Dead Wagon of the Somme. In 1919, whilst engaged on exhumation work, I was stationed near Poisiers on the Somme. My sleeping quarters were in a shallow dugout which ran underneath the remains of the road crossing the main Albert to Bapaume road, close to where the Australian Memorial now stands. On my second night there, I was awakened by the unmistakable rattle and jingle which every ex-soldier would recognise as that of a wagon, GS, General Service Wagon, and it seemed as though the wagon was proceeding at a trot along the old road outside the dugout. I was not the only man who heard it, for as I rose on my elbow to listen, a tense voice from the darkness said, "There it goes again." I asked the speaker, a sergeant of an Irish regiment, what the noise was. Another voice answered me and said, "It's the dead wagon from Contlemason. It comes every so often, but none of us has ever seen it." I passed it off, thinking the noise was due to our transport en route from one camp to another. But on further thought, I realised this could not be so. For one thing, there was no night movements in operation at that time. And secondly, neither horse nor motor transport could have used the road, for it was pitted with deep shell holes and impassable a short way from the camp. After hearing the sound on several nights, I decided to investigate. One night I heard the jingle approaching from the direction of Contlemason. I rushed out, and although it was a clear night, I could see no sign of any wagon, but I could distinctly hear the sound disappearing in the direction of Courcelette. What was it? A day or two afterwards, I was exploring the shell-scarred ground in the vicinity in company with a sergeant of the Australians who'd been in the area during the attack in 1916, and we came across a derelict German GS wagon with the skeletons of two horses lying in a badly shattered part of the old road previously mentioned. The Australian had an experience to relate about this. It appeared that during the 1916 battle, a German GS wagon did collect dead from the Contlemason district at night, and it was believed carried the bodies to Courcelette. One night, a British shell caught the wagon and beheaded the two soldiers on the box seat and killed the horses. The wagon was the very one we were looking at, and the Australian went on to describe how he'd later assisted to bury the headless men and the contents of the wagon. This, he said, was the dead wagon that we heard pass over our heads at the dead of night. I'm not in the least superstitious and I do not believe in the occult, but I certainly did hear the wagon on several occasions, and it's also certain that no wagon could possibly have traversed the road at that time. Does make you think, doesn't it? So this next account takes us to 1928, and it comes in chapter one of a great book written by H.A. Taylor, Goodbye to the Battlefields. I've quoted from this book before, and no doubt we'll be doing it again in future episodes. He says, at the gateway to the Somme, he said, "I decided to enter the Somme area as most soldiers entered it through its northern gateway. Accordingly, I approached the Somme battlefields by way of Albert, the battered, blasted little town, which in 1918 was just a heap of red rubble. Thus it was, on a summer morning, I alighted at an imposing new station of four platforms, complete with white-tiled subway, a buffet and a bookstall. One did not alight at Albert station in the war years. It was not done. The only arrivals at Albert station were substantial shells which came via the Poisiers Ridge. As a result, the new station is not the old one reconstructed, for there was nothing to reconstruct, but an entirely new structure a little to the south of the ruined station, of which no trace now remains. Albert's war story is a double tragedy. For nearly 2 years prior to July 1916, the enemy sat above the little town and flung heavy projectiles into it, using as a ranging point the cathedral, whose massive walls of brick and stone were visible to the naked eye from the observation posts. Then, with the opening of the offensive, the town came in for special concentrated hate, for the enemy guessed, and rightly, that its cellars were crammed with men and that its streets at night were alive with troops and transport. When the attacks of 1916 had pushed the guns far beyond the Bapaume Ridge, Albert enjoyed a little peace. Working parties shovelled its tumbled houses from the roadways and tidied up the place so that it had some resemblance of its former shape. For all its ruined condition, Albert was then a desirable place after a spell in the mud near Miremont or Courcelette, particularly after the return of some of the inhabitants and then the opening of a few hastily patched up shops. On a wretched winter's night after the first adventurous civilians had returned to the town, I was picking my way among the shell holes of Albert when sounds of singing, led by a concertina, could be heard above the rumble of the guns. Such an exhibition of cheerfulness in such a dismal environment on such a night merited investigation. Peering between rough timbers which filled the cavity that was once a shopfront, I encountered an amusing spectacle. Candles revealed, seated on a few boxes and even on the floor, a number of soldiers, typical infantrymen, wearing steel helmets and those quaint sheepskin jerkins fashionable in the winter of 1916-17. With mess tins and even old ration cans for tumblers, the soldiers were drinking beer. It must have been thin stuff, but it was beer, and any ex-serviceman will tell you at such times there really is no bad beer. The beverage had elevated them just sufficiently to enable them to look beyond present discomforts and embarrassments and to visualise the end of hostilities. As the instrumentalist swayed his concertina left and right and gave it an occasional flourish above his head, his shaggy-coated comrades sang a familiar war ballad. There are some trivial episodes which memory insists upon associating with certain places. This cameo of the singing soldiers is one which always comes to mind when I think of Albert. In the spring of 1917, many civilians returned. Shops and villas were rebuilt or repaired, and it was good to come here after a spell of duty before the Hindenburg line. General Byng made his headquarters in the town, and it was here that he conceived the remarkable attack of November 1917, when he almost snatched Cambrai from the enemy's grip. Albert was a peaceful back area town in those days. Then in 1918, the unbelievable happened, and the enemy hordes came with incredible speed over the hills that separated Albert from Cambrai. Peronne fell, Bapaume followed, and soon shells again came screaming over the Poisier Ridge. The new plate glass windows of Albert were shattered, its new roofs were breached, worse followed. The town was mercifully bombed from the air and finally captured. Taylor then goes on to tell us about how they built the Basilica, the cathedral in Albert. He says, for several years immediately following the armistice, one saw on a temporary church a brightly gilded effigy of the original Virgin holding the child heavenwards, as in the old times. But this was not the original figure. It was a replica, considerably smaller. Close by, the ruins of the old cathedral remained much as they were in 1918. For nearly 10 years, the Albert Cathedral remained thus. But the devout people of the town were determined that their Byzantine treasure should be restored to them. The building being only 60 years old, and inquiries concerning the whereabouts of the plans were begun. The actual plans could not be found, but a son of the architect was traced, and he had in his possession a duplicate set of drawings. There was great joy over this discovery, for although some millions were required to rebuild the cathedral, the principal obstacle had been overcome. And today, Albert Cathedral stands brick for brick and stone for stone as it stood in August of 1914. Except, Taylor says, in 1928, the bricks and stones are glaringly new and the effigy of the Virgin shines as only new gilt can shine in the sun's rays. For the most part, the church has been built upon the old foundations, which accomplishment represents something of an engineering feat, because the River Onk runs through the site. Indeed, if you go there now, as I said before, the scene that you see when you look up at the basilica is almost exactly as he's described it there. The sun still shines on the Golden Virgin, and you can still see the river flowing through the centre of Ypres as it goes beneath the basilica. The new cathedral is now encircled by streets of handsome shops and fine fronts and attractive displays of wares. Here and there, an ugly vacant site breaks this array of new buildings, and even today your eye will light upon the remains of a petrol tin that may have done duty as a water container in 1916, or a piece of harness that, could it speak, might tell of a flame-lit night of horror in March of 1918. Albert today claims a population larger than which it held before the war. One reason for this is the establishment of an aeroplane factory employing about 1,000 men, so that even now the buzz of aircraft can be heard above the town. Then there is a small colony of Britons. Some of them are employed by the Imperial War Graves Commission. Others are former temporary employees of the commission, ex-servicemen who, having married French women, have settled down to civilian occupations. These men are happy and contented. At least they are not troubled by strikes and unemployment. That's what was going on back home in the UK at that time. One important section of these exiles is composed of drivers of motor cars who make a living by driving British visitors to war cemeteries or by running them around the battlefields. Generally, they are very good fellows, these former soldiers. Now, at the time of Taylor's visit in 1928, the Second World War is 11 years away, and the occupation of Albert is 12 years away. I wonder what happened to those British men that married local women. I wonder what happened to them in the Second World War. In these places, you may hear a British veteran telling tales of the war to some unsuspecting visitor. "Yes," said one in my hearing, "my pal was wounded 33 times, and he wore a wound stripe for every one he did, but the 34th did him in. He was killed by a bomb as he lay in the hospital at Etaps. Rotten luck. Thanks. I'll have the same drink again." Just reading that final account there, and it reminds me of talking to Richard Dunning, the owner of Lochnagar Crater, about the stories that he tells of meeting veterans during the 1970s. And that inspired him to want to preserve that crater. And also from people like Paul Reed, who tells on his podcast, The Old Front Line, how as a young man, he went round the nursing homes of Sussex talking to these veterans who no doubt told him stories like the one we've just read. And just thinking about that, I remember growing up as a young lad here in Northampton, and in the bungalow next door to where we live with my parents, there was an old boy who used to shuffle around the garden. This was, I suppose, in the 1970s. He only had one arm and he was so bad-tempered, we used to give him a wide berth. And I remember my brother once asked him, "What happened to your other arm, mate?" And he said, "I left it on the Somme." And, you know, I was desperate to ask him more questions about it. But as a teenager, young teenager, I was too scared to. And so was my brother. So we left him to it. It's only now, of course, I wish that I had asked him what had happened. I can't even remember his name. Bill, I think he was, but I don't know any more than that. One of those regrets, isn't it? This next account I found in newspaper archives and is dated May 1921 and is written by a journalist who's called his article "Back to Trenchland." And he says, "Heaps of crumbling brickwork do show where once houses stood, masses of rotting timber and twisted fragments of rusted iron, irregular lines of trenches across fields of weeds, pitted with gaping holes and littered with the rubbish of war. Here and there, the skeleton of a horse, a lonely grave or so, a track of broken duckboards, a discarded rifle, a shattered tank. The Somme country today is very much as we left it in 1918. Rain was falling when we arrived at Albert, a rain soft and gentle as a woman's tears. It seemed as if all the mothers who once lived in Picardy were mourning their lost sons and vanished homes. We were the only two to leave the train at Albert, and the porter seemed surprised to see us. A few of the inhabitants have returned to the town. A cafe has been erected. Some temporary shelters have been built. There are a score of workmen repairing the road and filling in shell holes in the pavements. The porter could not understand why anyone would leave the pleasures of Paris to see such things as these. I did not satisfy his curiosity. Memories. That broken wall is all that's left of our billet where we rested before going up into the trenches on the morning in July that saw the opening of the Somme battles. Here, behind the mound that represents the cathedral, is the site of the little shop kept by a kindly French woman. She was killed on the night of the big raid during the March retreat. In one of the cellars, some of the best pals a man ever had died violent deaths. We found their graves up on the Bapaume Road. There'll be roses blooming again in Picardy this summer. Cuttings from English rose trees have been planted around the sides of the cemeteries near Fricourt, by the lake Ovillé, and round the roadside, once close to the crater at Les Boisselles. Already the buds are showing. There are only 33 stumps of trees remaining in Tiquetval Wood. I counted them. All are dead. We walk to Avalou and return to Albert by the road that runs past the old baths. There is another large cemetery where the long-range guns used to be hidden. In none of the Somme cemeteries did we see any of the headstones which the graves commissionaires proposed erecting. As the train left the station on its way back to Paris, Kitty stood up and looked out on those poor, battered homes and pitiful wooden crosses. Then she burst into tears. I wonder who Kitty was. I wonder what she was thinking. In the early 1930s, another author, a Canadian, Will Bird, wrote a book called 13 Years After. He said of Albert, it's all very modern, and Albert sees a multitude of tourists. Here and there we spot the old ruins, but the Grand Place and the Hotel de Ville are most imposing. And the famous writer Vera Brittain, she visited town twice. In 1921, on that first visit, she said this: "There's a humped ruin of stones and dust with a few huts of reconstruction workers dotted here and there. Now a clean, bright new town, though considerable smaller than the original, which was, as chauffeur said, the Coventry of France, and made bicycles and machinery. It now makes aeroplanes at a factory, one of the best in northern France, which employs workers from all parts." When she was there, she had lunch at one of the hotels in Albert. The owner was an Italian and he'd fought on the Italian front and later moved to France and had become a waiter before he bought the hotel where she was having lunch. A visit to the Somme battlefields is always special for whatever reason you go there. But please, if you make that visit to the Somme, do spare time to visit Albert. And if you do, next to the Basilica is a museum. One of the first places that I visited when I went there. The Somme Museum from 1916. It was set up in the mid-1980s. And it makes use of the many tunnels that are beneath the Basilica and the main square, some of which date back to medieval times. And I believe they were used by the locals during the Second World War as an air raid shelter. And this museum recreates the life of soldiers in the trenches of July 1916. And most of the exhibits are housed in one of those tunnels that's 250 metres long and 10 metres below the surface. There are various little alcoves off of that main tunnel which tell the tales of trench warfare on the Somme. It talks about the rats, the mud and the trenches. And there's also 25 display cabinets which you can study all kinds of World War I artifacts and weaponry. And there's one room where you can get sound and light effects that add to your experience. And it really does take you back to the time of the Great War. And then just before you leave the museum, of course, there's a shop there that always is. But you go through what they call the Gallery of Heroes, dedicated to nine individuals who distinguished themselves during the Great War. I suppose when you think about it, that Albert is the Somme's equivalent to Ypres. up in Belgium, much less known, much less visited. But it should be visited. There's so much to see, there's so much to experience there. It's the gateway to the Somme, really. In a few weeks' time, I will return there on my first visit of 2026, 25 years after my first visit in 2001. Tens of thousands of those men that were billeted or passed through Albert, like my great uncle Henry, are still there, their bodies buried beneath the battlefields, or in Henry's case, beneath the Commonwealth War Graves Commission headstone. Whether they lived or whether they died, their spirits, their ghosts, if you like, the echoes of those men, they'll be there forever and ever, won't they? And we'll remember them, as we often do in the podcast, by the sounding of the last post. Mm-hmm.